our investigation, it shows that more people were involved in either the planning of it or carrying out of it. Those people certainly will be charged also.
A short time ago, President Clinton spoke to an audience in Washington, D.C. He urged parents to talk with their children about the tragedy.
Parents should take this moment to ask what else they can do to shield our children from violent images and experiences that warp young perceptions and obscure the consequences of violence.
The bodies of the school victims were left in the facility overnight while officers continued their search for explosive devices. Nearly 30 incendiary devices have been found. Some of them are on timers. NATO says its pilots have struck 30 more targets in Kosovo and the rest of Yugoslavia. Among the damaged sites is the Serbian Socialist Party headquarters. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Brussels.
NATO pilots have struck another bridge over the Danube River at Novi Sad. Command and control lines, radio relay stations, and ammunition storage sites were also hit. NATO bombs attacked what British briefers called the nerve center of President Slobodan Milosevic's political machine. The Socialist Party headquarters was burned in Belgrade. In a move to expand the air campaign, NATO officials today meet with the Prime Minister of Bulgaria. Like Romania, Bulgaria has given permission to NATO to use its airspace in what is becoming an intensified bombing campaign to break the resolve of the Serbian forces. They are showing little signs of stopping. Serb troops were reported to have crossed into the peninsula of Prevlaka, a finger of Croatia that is a demilitarized zone under UN control. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Brussels.
Conservative activist Gary Bauer has announced his candidacy for the Republican presidential nomination. A former Reagan White House advisor, Bauer's run conservative political organizations and was most recently associated with the Family Research Council. Bauer faces a crowded field. Other presidential candidates include former Vice President Dan Quayle, political commentator Pat Buchanan, radio broadcaster Alan Keyes, New Hampshire Senator Bob Smith, and millionaire businessman Steve Forbes. Two undeclared but formidable opponents may be Red Cross President Elizabeth Dole and Texas Governor George W. Bush. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 16 points. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, it is another blizzard of earnings news today for Wall Street investors. There's upbeat profit news from several big companies. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
With the positive earnings continuing to pour in, the financial markets seem to be in good spirits today. Insurance company Allstate and toothpaste maker Colgate-Palmolive are both reporting record profits. And the fact that software maker Microsoft beat quarterly expectations has given the technology sector a boost. Also reporting better-than-expected earnings numbers, beverage maker Coca-Cola, though quarterly profits were down for the world's biggest soft drink maker, the company says the dip was less severe than some Wall Street forecasts. For many analysts, these kinds of numbers signal a healthy economy. That would mean the downturn in some company shares earlier this week was only a temporary correction. As one analyst put it, I think the market can walk and chew gum at the same time. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
An Italian telephone company has agreed in principle to merge with Germany's Deutsche Telekom, but there are strings attached. Telecom Italia wants to know whether the deal would be a merger of equals, but it's not clear how much power each company would wield in the newly merged corporation. If a new company was created, it would outstrip competitors and would create the largest merger in history. The largest grain company in the country, Cargill, says its planned acquisition of Continental Grain of Kansas will give Kansas farmers better access to world grain markets, but the Agriculture Department expresses some concern. Officials say they're worried that the combined firms could stifle or drive out competition in some local markets and control a large percentage of American grain exports. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from Borders.com, putting a world of books, music, and videos at your fingertips. www.borders.com.
Good morning and welcome to Odyssey on WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. As consumers, you may think it's obvious that we have an economy that produces vastly more things than it used to. from cellular phones to dinosaur-shaped SpaghettiOs to a seemingly infinite variety of khaki pants. That's not even to mention the services we have now that didn't used to exist, like online stock trading or pet psychiatrists. You might think that this increased variety is a sign that we are becoming more productive, and you might also think that computer technology is making us more productive. But you might be wrong. Productivity has grown relatively slowly until very recently, and the notion that information technology has yielded increases in productivity, or that it ever will, is controversial. According to the New York Times last week, economists are coming around to the view that the so-called computer revolution is finally kicking in, and the growth of productivity in the last 2 years is just a hint of large gains to come. Some never doubted it, and some still don't see it. So how should we know if computers have really made a difference? And if they have or haven't, what difference does that make? We're going to talk about that subject today on the program. Joining me for the conversation from Northwestern University, Shane Greenstein, who is Associate Professor in the Management and Strategy Department of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern. And joining us from New York is Jeff Madrick, who is editor of Challenge Magazine and the author of The End of Affluence, The Causes and Consequences of America's Economic Dilemma. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for joining me this morning. Jeff Madrick, I'll begin with you. Can you talk a little bit about where we are in terms of productivity growth? This is the past couple of decades have been historically not all that spectacular.
Well, as best we can determine, productivity, which we should define, I think, as the goods and services are what comprise GDP, and the amount of goods and services per hour of work that the economy produces is productivity, the conventional measure of labor productivity. The best data we have is that between 1870 and about 1970, productivity grew on average, and I stress on average, by more than 2% a year, labor productivity. It obviously went up and down in the business cycles, but if you average it out, more than 2% a year. Since 1973 or so, it has grown on average by 1% a year. That's an enormous difference over time. 1% seems like only 1%, of course, in a single year. But as its effects accumulate over time, it's an enormous difference. It means the difference, I haven't done the data, run the numbers recently, the difference between 25 or 30% in total GDP by the end of a 25 or 30-year period.
Now, we're talking about growth in productivity. In other words, we're more productive today than we were, obviously, 100 years ago, much more productive.
Much more.
We're in a period where we're not increasing our productivity particularly quickly.
Right. That's exactly how to describe it.
But in the last couple of years, we've seen the size of growth in productivity has grown, and some experts want to attribute this to the gains in productivity from investment in information technology. Now, but before we get into whether that's the right assessment or not, what sort of time frame are we talking about when we talk about investment in information technology? And people buy computer equipment all the time. What sort of period of time should we be looking at if we want to assess the impact of computer technology on the economy? Shane Greenstein?
Well, the difficulty here, and Jeff is beginning to touch on it, is that there are going to be many confounding factors when you look at a long time series. So, for example, we have to remember that the 70s were characterized by some pretty deep recessions in the United States. And we have to remember that the post-World War II era of growth in the United States was characterized by an increasing shift of economic activity to services. And so one of the difficulties we're going to run into when assessing productivity is how do you assess productivity across activities, which are in many respects apples and oranges and different from each other. And I'm sure we'll get into it today. Jeff is correct in the numbers that he states, and the question that arises immediately is whether the way we think of productivity, which was designed for an economy that was primarily associated with manufacturing activity, if anything, the pre-World War II economy, whether that way of looking at the world, goods and services per labor.
whether that's a good way to a little debate on that.
Okay, go ahead, Jeff Madrick, because you've written about this issue, because people, Shane Greenstein among them, obviously, suggest that we're not measuring productivity as accurately as we could, and we're missing a lot of things that are going on. Why don't you talk about why you think that's not
the case? Well, I don't think that's quite as relevant as Shane thinks it is. The question is, we have a very service-oriented economy, but in the 19th century, we were a pretty service-oriented economy as well. Remember, the railroads were what we classify as a service, and everybody thinks that was the great engine of growth, in part because it required all that steel and so much investment. But nevertheless, it was a service. That service increased in productivity rapidly as trains got much more went much more rapidly and were more efficient and got bigger and could carry heavier loads. When the A&P was started in the late 19th century, the same thing occurred. That's a service, retailing. It got much more, I'm fighting a cold, it got much more productive over time. So services always played a distribution, which is a service, distribution and marketing of goods, always played a very large part in the American economy. The question is, have services changed in the last couple of decades in a way? They've gotten to be a larger part of the economy, but have they changed in a way that makes them significantly harder to measure? That is a very ambiguous subject. And my sense of it is, based on the work of several economists, but notably Dan Sickle, is that even if we allow that they are being undermeasured, the change in service, we're only talking about a change in measurement of a few tenths of a percent a year. So the question is, are we mismeasuring more now significantly than we used to mismeasure before 1970?
Shane,
my argument is we are only mismeasuring slightly.
Shane, you obviously think that that's a bigger issue. Can you talk a little bit about why you think that?
Oh, we're going to have some fun here. let's try to keep this at a level where everybody, I guess, will understand it. I guess if you look at the numbers in manufacturing, there really isn't much of a productivity debate there. So let's at least start with that. In the manufacturing sector of the U.S. economy after the Second World War, there was a slowdown in productivity growth in the 70s and early 80s. And then since then, there really hasn't been anything like a productivity slowdown. There's been normal productivity growth on the order of 3% and so on. It's in the rest of the economy that you don't get a measured part of growth, and the rest of the economy accounts for two-thirds of it. And so I in some ways, I'll agree with Jeff. Warehousing hasn't gone away. It's still a part of the economy. It was a part of the economy 100 years ago. Transportation services haven't gone away. It was there 100 years ago, still is now, and we still don't measure it particularly well. But financial services are here today that weren't there 100 years ago, and we don't measure those particularly well. Health services are here today that certainly weren't there 100 years ago, and again, we don't measure those at all very well.
So do you think that productivity, are you saying that there's been productivity growths in those sectors that we have that we're undercounting? Is that by a greater factor than Jeff is suggesting?
I guess the argument is, if we're likely to make a mistake, it's going to be in areas such as health services, transportation services, financial services, government services, where we can argue whether there's productivity growth or not. It's sort of a fun question, too. And we're likely to make all our mistakes there, and as an increasing percentage of the economy has moved into those areas, we're likely to misunderstand them, or at least not have good information about them. And in the part of the economy that we do have good information on, which is in manufacturing, there's not much of an argument. At least that's the way it looks. I'd be curious if Jeff saw that otherwise.
Yeah, I think there's always been. Here's the irony of this kind of debate. It's a perennial debate. In 1962.
Yes.
As Shane well knows, I realize, there was a committee formed that said, hey, we're mismeasuring the amount of benefit we get, not from services for the most part, but from goods, manufactured goods. We're miscounting that somehow. Now, what happens is, and this might be a little technical, this area is very ambiguous. Because what economists try to do is it says, well, how much extra quality are we getting from these new goods? And if a car is much better than it used to be, and you're paying twice as much for that car, well, you're not really paying twice as much for that car because you're getting a better car. So we have to adjust prices for that. Well, this kind of argument was made in 1962, not about services, but about goods. The reason I bring that up is I'm trying to point out how ambiguous this can be.
The whole issue of measuring productivity.
The whole issue of measuring quality.
All right, well, let me ask a question, though, because both of you mentioned the services sector and whether that the accurate measurement or inaccurate measurement there, what significance that has in overall productivity figures. But what I'd like to know is, are those sectors where one would expect to find gains based on investment in information technology? Are those sectors that are supposed to benefit greatly from computer technology?
Well, allegedly, but I have a different view of that than most people do. I think all sectors, I think the automobile industry, which is always the classic manufactured good, has benefited enormously from computerized operations. We have many more choices of automobiles than we did in the 1950s and 60s, and they're much more durable and generally of a higher quality than they used to. A lot of that has to do with electronic operations and managerial improvements. My own view of this, which is controversial, but nevertheless, I believe, is correct, is that there's something highly ironic going on here. In an information age, when information is no longer as valuable as it once was because it's so accessible. In the old economy, to use a dubious expression, but anyway, in the former economy,
yes,
information counted for a lot. Knowing how to do something, having a competitive advantage and so forth, counted for a lot. Today, what counts for a lot is what you do with that information. And think about it for a second. What you do with that information requires a lot of human input. So while we can get rid of clerks in the insurance company, or the financial services that Shane's talking about, in order to operate more efficiently, what we really need in the financial services is a lot more human input, creative input. My sense of what may be going on, and it's very hard to prove, but there is some kind of circumstantial evidence, is the economy in some way is getting more labor-intensive than it would have gotten under a normal mass production system. And I think that's what's holding productivity down. I think the mismeasurement issue is a very small issue. There is something more fundamental that we don't understand. It's a kind of return to a crafts economy of a very different type than what we think of as a crafts economy, but of a type that requires human input in ways economists haven't had to deal with and therefore don't really understand yet.
Shane Greenstein, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think we're actually going to agree on two of three points here. So let's go back to the first one on automobiles, because that actually illustrates part of the problem, and then let's get to the second comment about crafts, which is I think actually a very provocative observation. So the first comment about the automobile, the problem with measuring what's a improvement in an automobile is represented by the fins of a car. Changes in styling are changes that somebody's willing to pay for. So now the question you have to ask is if the automobile companies get better at providing a wide variety of styles, is that a productivity improvement? And that was exactly the kind of question that the committee that Jeff referred to really got sort of hung up on. What turned out from that whole debate was there were some things that we all agree unambiguously are improvements, and what the government agencies ended up doing was, when we could all unambiguously agree that these were improvements, they would try to put them into the statistics. So, for example, in the modern day, when a computer is faster, when it has more memory, and it still costs the same price, I guess we all agree that's better, and so we count that as a productivity advance. However, when the Macintosh comes out with five, six different colors, even though that probably improved a lot of people's lives, that's not called a productivity advance. Yeah, because it's too close to being something that we might think of as fashion. And that's sort of the dividing line, and the government agencies still sort of think that way. And that's sort of one of the sources of ambiguity.
Well, so let me sidetrack you here before you get to the second point, because you think that that is something that ought to be counted as a productivity gain? I mean, like an increase in consumer satisfaction with the product? I mean, because you get to have a pink iMac instead of a blue iMac, and it makes you happier?
Well, that's...
How do you ask that question?
Right? Yeah.
I'm very anxious to hear Shane's answer.
Actually part of where Jeff and I are going to disagree. Here's the tricky problem. When you measure productivity, it's traditionally thought of by government agencies, it's usually associated with output as measured by producers. If you instead had a definition of output as measured as experienced by users, then you would actually have conceptually a different way of thinking about productivity. And in that sense, thinking about output as measured by users, greater variety actually is a valuable thing.
May I respond to that, Shane?
Sure. And then Shane will go back to point two.
That's an important point, and it may get lost, I realize, for listeners who haven't thought about this for a while, as Shane and I have. I don't particularly agree with Shane, and let me tell you why. It's very difficult to determine what are great increases in consumer satisfaction. And if we started talking about variety as being this enormous increase in consumer satisfaction, we'd have to go rewrite all of economic history. The Boskin Commission, to which he refers, makes this something of a big deal about the increased variety. So now we have 12 or 50 more bottles of beer to choose from than we did 25 years ago, different kinds of beers. How is that compared to having, in the late 19th century, your first bottle of nickel beer available to you? Until you had that bottle of beer available, you had to brew the beer yourself. What's the increase in satisfaction, and do we account for similar increases in satisfaction and past historical data? There's a talk about in the Boskin Commission. It drives me crazy, as I'm sure Shane knows. It disagrees with increased variety of fresh fruit in wintertime. And then I look at the more anecdotal evidence about how consumers behaved in the last 20 years. What we're talking about in productivity is an increase in output, an increase in effect in the income of people, in the services and goods they derive per hour of work. If fresh fruit, increased variety of fresh fruit were so important, maybe people should have given up a tangerine and put an extra dollar in the bank, because they were so satisfied with that fruit, they could have done without a little bit because they had such a variety.
People saved
much less. Net worth didn't increase. It probably declined over the last 10 years. There's a social revolution in wives going to work. So if part of that, I applaud. I mean, I think it's great that women have the option to work. But most of the reason was pecuniary. They just needed the darn money. If we had all that extra output and satisfaction as consumers, doesn't it make sense we would have been a happier nation for 20 or 25 years, that we would have saved more, that we'd have fewer financial problems, that the surveys would show all this satisfaction?
Jeff and I are going to agree that the reference to fresh fruit drives me nuts too. I'm not particularly fond of that example either.
It was a big one for the Boskin Commission.
Yeah, yeah. Let me use an example that I think actually is a slightly harder one, and that's air conditioning. If you look at the history of air conditioning in the U.S., air conditioning units have gotten very good, primarily past World War II, and it changed the South. it changed pretty much everything south of the Mason-Dixon line, because it made life bearable, and during the summer months. And so this is one that really hits right at the sort of difference in perspectives. On the one hand, if you only measure output of air conditioners from producers, you don't see a lot of additional dollars going to air conditioners as they got better and better. You do see some volumes going up, but competition was competing away most of the extra money going to that, but the air conditions were getting better. And yet on the other hand, you just know people's lives were improved.
By the way, Gretchen, and as Shane well knows, he's citing a classic example.
Yes.
What happens because of what we might call the social returns of air conditioning. What happens is that you attract all that investment into Florida and to the Southwest, and you get all that economic development as a result of that. And guess what? Because people move there and it's cheaper there, you know, and you get a great rush of investment and people start to make more money and the way normal economies develop. And guess what? That does show up in productivity.
All right.
It does show up in increased output and services as is currently measured.
Shane, let me steer you back for a moment to the second point that we got sidetracked from, which had to do with Jeff's description of the economy as becoming more sort of craft-oriented.
Oh, yeah.
And this sort of gets back to the productivity issue in service sectors.
So on that point, actually, I think he and I are going to agree again. And maybe, the spin will be slightly different than the one he put on, but I think in character, we're very similar. It is correct. The word you used was craftsmanship, that it required a different labor activity from people
right,
today.
Greater
yeah.
Labor.
Yeah, I have to
yeah,
largely agree with
that.
Greater
labor intensity than we would have
yeah.
otherwise had in a more mass production oriented.
Yeah, yeah. I think I largely agree with that. That one of the interesting things that has arisen as a result of widespread diffusion of information technology into virtually all phases of administrative work, and all over the economy, is it's changed the nature of work, and the thing that's not happened is it's turned out to be quite difficult to substitute these sort of processes for labor. What they've tended to be instead are tools or complements to judgment, and so it's change the nature of the job without, in some sense, eliminating the job.
You mean substitute electronic tools for...
Yeah, yeah. And the way we used to think about productivity in its simplest form was about the diffusion of capital goods as a replacement for labor, and then it lets that labor go off and do something else that's productive, and that we see as a advance the economy. And information technology largely does not fit into that mold, at least not in a short run sense. And in that sense, I think that Jeff's right. What we've tended to find instead is we have isolated examples where IT or automation by the use of information technology did replace, in the long run, somebody's job, and then they went off to do something else. And in a traditional sense, that's a productivity advance. But largely, what's happened instead is that you've had to hire more trained workers in order to work with the IT, and then you had to use more careful judgment, and then you had to figure out what it was good for, and then you've had to reorganize administrative work to take advantage of that, and that's enabled many organizations to do some interesting and new things. And then this is actually where we'll now differ. Now you have to ask the question: are the new things that they're doing valuable and useful and worthwhile? And if you think by and large that they are, then you come to the conclusion that that's a productivity advance that we're not necessarily measuring. And if you don't think they're necessarily worthwhile or that it's a dubious at best, it's just spinning more wheels, and then you'll come more or less to Jeff's conclusion that, yeah, you know, it doesn't look like it's all that great. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think that they are worthwhile. I think it's a pretty good assessment, Shane. I'm glad to see you agree with part of that, because I'm writing a book about it, right?
We're going to try to get to the part where you guys disagree pretty
well,
soon.
Well, but we do disagree on this latter part, and it's very important. And in fact, the BLS did a paper and referred to my position, because I wrote some of this in the New York Review of Books. And they did say maybe some of this is a mismeasurement issue, because what we get is a lot more products as a result of this. They can appeal to, you know, niche markets, small, more narrow markets, individuals, and so forth and so on. But more products per se, to me, are measured as output by what we pay for them. There may be some additional mismeasurement, and I think Shane, where we disagree is that Shane thinks it could be a lot of additional mismeasurement.
Yeah, that's probably right.
I think it's very dangerous to start saying we should make some increase, add a number to our output because we have more variety and more products out there. And people somehow think this is future shock. But boy, when I look at the history of the 1920s or the 1880s, in 1920, approximately one out of six families owned an automobile. In 1929, 9 years later, 60% of all families own an automobile. Now, what was the contribution of that automobile to the way, to satisfaction and to the way lives were changed? Obviously, it was enormous. Are we saying that increased variety and specialization is comparable to that in some way? And how do we measure it? I think we measure it by what people are willing to pay for those products and those services. And for the most part, that is included in the data, just like the air conditioning data. People are running south, and we're developing. You know, we had great development and faster growth as a result of the air conditioning. So it wasn't merely what people spent for air conditioning. It was all those other products that were created for which they were paid and which showed up in the economy. And we're probably going to talk a little bit in circles that may just lose people, not because it's particularly complex, but it just takes some getting used to thinking about it in these terms.
All right, I need to take a short break.
Oh, okay.
When we come back, I'll let you make your point, Shane, but I also want to talk about the idea that gets batted around a lot that the investment in computer technology was not supposed to pay off for a number of years, that there would be a delayed payoff, and that's the pattern, that's what we're starting to see now. I'd like to get both of your responses to that idea. But we're talking today with Shane Greenstein, who is Associate Professor in the Management and Strategy Department of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern, and Jeff Madrick, who is editor of Challenge Magazine and the author of The End of Affluence, The Causes and Consequences of America's Economic Dilemma. When we come back, we'll also take your calls. Our number is 312-832-3124, 832-3124. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.
Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Artbeat Chicago on Channel 11. This week, Artbeat Chicago talks with Morton Grove native Marlene Matlin, plus boxing photographer Robert Dre. Artbeat Chicago, tonight at 7:30 on Channel 11. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Land's End Outlet, announcing their knit shirt event, It's Real Land's End, and an honest-to-goodness outlet.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Salman Rushdie about his new novel, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, and about his life now that the Iranian government is no longer calling for his death. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
That's Fresh Air at 2 o'clock, right after Talk of the Nation on WBEZ Chicago.
You're listening to 91.5 FM WBEZ Chicago. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Today we're talking about technology and productivity. My guests are Jeff Madrick, author of Challenge Magazine, editor of Challenge Magazine, and the author of The End of Affluence, The Causes and Consequences of America's Economic Dilemma, and Shane Greenstein, associate professor in the Management and Strategy Department of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern. Our phone number, if you'd like to ask a question or join in the conversation, is 312-832-3124, 832-3124. Shane, I cut you off just before the break. You wanted to respond to something?
Oh yeah, I don't want to get maudlin or anything, but on one level, I have to agree with Jeff in the sense that the end of hunger, the distribution of food across wide parts of the country, the introduction of reliable transportation systems at the turn of the century, the introduction of mass communication systems. I mean, these are fantastic. You know, the invention of penicillin by itself was itself a fantastic piece of invention. And
talk about unmeasured health benefits.
Yeah, unmeasured. And, on some levels, of course, I just have to agree with that. I mean, come on. I mean, that is marvelous, and it's unfortunate that, let's face it, two-thirds of the world still isn't even enjoying those benefits. And so on that level, I have to agree. And so then I come across to the other part, and this is something that keeps coming to mind. I just had my second child, and so I have to say this. So I have two children under the age of two, and I just had my second one recently, and I look at that little baby and I think, what is her world going to look like in 20 years? And as she grows up, she's going to be growing up with constant contact on the internet, and she's going to grow up with 3D visualization in these games that she plays. And on one level, I've got to admit that that isn't uh, that doesn't measure with the end of hunger at the turn of the century or the distribution of the automobile. And yet, on the other hand, I look at her and I think, I'm not going to be able to describe to her what it was like to grow up without this wired world. And to her, it's going to seem as much a revolution in her life. She won't understand how one could get by without it. And it's because, that I want to step back. When I see things diffuse like this that I know are changing the way people live, I don't want to pass a judgment that it isn't any more significant than anything else that's ever happened in the last 100 years. I don't want to pass that judgment. I want to, give my daughter the right 30 years from now to say this is really significant to the way we organize our lives.
And, I'm not passing that judgment either. Yeah. What I'm pointing out is that the same arguments that are made for the idea that this kind of thing is not included in the data can be made for the enormous innovations of the past.
Yes, I'll agree.
Let's not even talk about telecommunications. The sewing machine changed household labor extraordinarily. Now, that is not included in the data. So if we adjusted all the data, if we had some omniscient power who could adjust all the data precisely, my argument is that maybe we'd have to adjust recent data of the last 25 years up, but we'd probably have to adjust the data from the prior 100 years up even more. And what we're really talking about is the performance of the economy in the last 25 years compared to what it was before, because America got very accustomed to this rapid advance in standards of living. It's not the absolute level, it's the rate of change that matters. And historians, and I think many economists, and I think Shane, judging by what he's saying, is very sensitive to this, misunderstand how our social and political development was based on this very rapid change. My argument is not that times are not changing, and I think there are some very good possibilities that can come out of this. My argument is we've got a paradoxical economy. They're not changing in the same way they used to change. And income, per se, is not growing as rapidly as it once did, leaving many people behind and leaving many people in this situation where they can't participate in this great new world. 60% of people owned an automobile in 1929. Only 45% of families own a PC today. Something is different now, and I don't want this technological revolution, and it is one, to distract us from the hard facts. There is a paradox in the last 25 years, or even in the last 5 years, and I really want to call attention to that. We are not. This economy is not delivering those fundamental income goods the way they did in the past, and we're not growing as fast.
All right. Let me give our phone number again. It's 312-832-3124. 832-3124. Let me ask each of you to address this scenario that gets batted around when people talk about this issue, the gains from computer technology are going to be like the gains from electricity, where it took at least 20 years before people figured out what to do with electricity and how to become more productive, and that we are now on the threshold of that era. We've had the computer technology, the PCs have been sitting on our desks for a while now, or in the palms of our hands or whatever, and we're just now starting to figure out, hey, we could do this whole, we could change the paradigm, so to speak, and come up with A, new things to do, B, better ways to do them, all sorts of things, and that this is just starting, and this accounts for the increases just since 1997 in productivity that we're seeing, or 1996, I guess, in productivity. What do you think about that scenario, Shane? Do you think that that's a good picture of what we ought to expect? And the reason I ask, and I'll ask you to address this, is because that says a lot about what we can expect in the coming years.
It builds really quite well off what Jeff was just saying. I guess my own view of the matter is that IT, like most general purpose technologies, is not immediately useful except in a small number of applications, and its use and therefore long-term economic value depends on its adaptation to new problems and its customization to the idiosyncrasies of unique places and the idiosyncrasies of unique industries. And that customization is done by manufacturers, but it's also mostly actually done by users, and oftentimes by third parties who had nothing to do with the initial diffusion. And so in that respect, it's similar to electricity in that it took many decades after the invention of electricity as a scientific invention before anybody figured out what it was good for or before its use was widespread. And so, you know, when I look at IT today and I think the internet today, you know, I think we're 3-4 years into the explosion of the internet. Oh, the next 10 to 20 is going to be the hard part. This is where the idiosyncrasies of what it's really going to be good for, where somebody with some vision and imagination applies it in a way that nobody can forecast at the moment. That's where you get the big gains. And that's where it changes people's lives, if it's going to change people's lives at all. And so, you know, that's the sense in which it is very, very slow.
Jeff Madrick?
Yeah, this is a thesis that Paul David, an economic historian out of Stanford, presented several years ago. I think it's partly true and partly not applicable, and maybe Shane doesn't particularly disagree with this. First of all, there was not a huge... Paul David makes a big deal about a huge slowdown and productivity around the turn of the century. It wasn't nearly as great a slowdown around that period of time, if our data are correct, as there is today. In fact, services productivity grew pretty rapidly around that period. So the introduction of electricity, there's some argument that, you know, we have a slowdown now. And I don't think the historical analogy is quite right, but I think there are some potentially analogous situations. Where I think it is grossly wrong, though anything could happen, is number one, electricity. It was a huge power source, number one. And number two, it dovetailed very neatly with the mass production environment of the time. So what we got was factories could now power their businesses at much lower costs, power their machinery and so forth and so on, compared to using coal and to some degree, I guess oil was used, but it was most coal at that time, I guess. And it fit very neatly into this whole mass marketing phenomenon, where suddenly there was this burst of, you know, radios and record players and washing machines that were powered by electricity in the home. It fit into the mass production, forgive the word, paradigm of the past very neatly. I don't think, I think it was the mass production that was really the great motivator of productivity gains, because that's how you removed labor from the production process very rapidly. So I'm not convinced by that analogy at all. I think it's kind of wishful thinking.
There would have to be some change in process or change in practice,
yeah,
analogous to
so.
Mass production
electricity
to take advantage.
Had a far broader impact.
Yeah, actually, I agree with that completely. I think that if you carried the analogy into that realm, actually, you'd go too far. I actually disagree with Paul on that point. So in some sense, I'm agreeing with you. The part of the analogy that works is the introduction of a technology into the assembly line. At first, made it a little easier, and then they reorganized the assembly lines. But you know, that's as far as you'd want to take the analogy. And Paul does take it much further than that.
Yeah,
and I think that's too far.
Shane, the computers have been around for a lot more than 15 or 20 years.
Oh yeah.
IBM
no.
was the giant company in the late 50s, and it wasn't because it sold calculators. It sold big computers.
Let's take some phone calls. 312-832-3124 is our phone number. Let's talk with Dave. Good morning, Dave. You're on WBEZ.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
In response to the comment about changes being made by the user, in my job I work for a social service agency in the west and south side of Chicago, and I see a lot of children and families who don't have access to computers, and I was wondering, since this is about technology and its effect on society, I'm wondering about the future for these people, especially as our society could be divided along, you know, social, cultural, ethnic, racial, and economic lines. And what are your comments about that?
All right, Jeff Madrick, you were talking about that a little bit when
yeah,
you were
I'm
talking
very
about
worried the. About fragment. I think one of the things that's occurred, we see it in inequality of income all over the place. But we see in a lot of the political and social attitudes today, there's a real fragmenting of society, and I think between haves and have-nots. And there's been a lot of, sometimes they even use this argument, you know, the poor have VCRs, they have color TV sets, they have microwave ovens, what are they complaining about? Well, I'll tell you what they're complaining about. They don't have decent health care. They have poor education for the most part. The cost of private education has soared. And they don't have PCs. And I'm very worried about this kind of political attitude.
So do you think that the line between if the haves and the have-nots are divided into those who have technology or information technology and those who don't, do you think that's going to be a significant fault line? I mean, not just income, in other words.
I would like to hear Shan's response. Yeah, I think it will be, because it'll be the means of communication and keeping in touch with the world. That's not a contradiction of my notion that it won't raise productivity across the
mm-hmm,
world.
Mm-hmm.
This is the problem of the modern era. So I think Jeff and I are going to be on the same level. I mean, the commercial markets will solve some problems and will not solve distribution problems. I mean, it's just the nature of the business that commercial markets don't worry about distribution issues and don't worry about a 15% of society not using something. And if the use of that technology becomes essential to carrying on in life, you know, commercial markets aren't going to do anything about it. And that is that's a real, real serious issue. The caller talked about divisions along income lines. There's also divisions along geography. You know, there are small towns in the country, in the rural parts of this country, that are going to be severely disadvantaged because they don't have access to high-speed communication links also. And that's another line of division. And, you know, I absolutely agree. It's going to be the most serious social problem in the technology world. On top of that, it's been piled on top of a whole series of other social problems. So it's not in itself going to solve all of society. You know, if we put PCs in a poor school, it's not going to solve everything either. So it's not a panacea by any stretch.
All right, Dave, thanks very much for your call. 312-832-3124. Let's talk to Skip. Good morning, Skip. You're on WBEZ.
Good morning. Early on, a gentleman from New York spoke about the baseline of productivity measuring from 1870 to 1970. I don't see how you can use it as a baseline. As an example, buggy whip manufacturers and Conestoga wagon manufacturers and people who horseshoed horses don't exist anymore, so they just fell off the map, so to speak. As an example, which I use personally as a typewriter, could be measured because in 1870 you had rudimentary typewriters, what we would call rudimentary today. You also have them today, electric ones that type a great deal because they have memory. You can measure that, but you can't measure other factors that don't exist. And industries, whole industries that grew up in the last 25 years or since the end of World War II never existed in 1870 at that time. You can't measure apples and oranges.
Is that, well, Jeff Madrick, do you see that?
It's a measurement of the entire economy. So the economies change all the time. The composition of the economy changes all the time. But we can measure the output by adding up what is being produced at various times. And that's what productivity is about. It's not comparing the productivity of handwriting versus word handwriting in the 19th century, although typewriters did come along then, and word processing today. You're looking at the entire composition of the economy and trying to determine the productivity that way. So yeah, industries go by the board, but other industries replace them, and presumably people prefer the output of the industries that replace them.
So you're not looking at, you're not measuring productivity within a given industry, you're measuring labor compared to output, and regardless of what that labor might do.
Very good. Yeah.
Shane?
This is one of the the caller has alluded to one of the classic questions of productivity measurement. What is it when the car replaces the buggy? There's going to be an industry whose value is going to be completely depreciated, and if you want to do a correct calculation of the benefits associated with the car, you actually have to also account for the lost capital value of all those investments that went into buggy manufacturing. I mean, if you want to be careful about it, and so generally when you do that sort of exercise, you usually find that there's no such thing as a hero in technology, that usually even something as dramatic as the car turns out to create value that's not a whole lot more than what was associated with the buggies. And so then you're left with this paradox, which is, well, then why was this so important? And that's where I come down slightly differently than Jeff, which is that, well, if you buy more convenience for someone, or if you buy fewer headaches, you know, that it's a slippery slope, to be sure, but it is an improvement in life, and that should be thought of as a productivity improvement as well.
All right, Skip, thanks very much for your call. Let's see if we can get through a few more calls before the end of the hour. Let's talk with Chad. Good morning, Chad. You're on WBEZ.
Good morning.
Hi.
How is everyone?
Fine.
Very good. I just wanted to call, and I think that you all are using the wrong analogy. When you were using electricity to compare it to the computer revolution, so-called, I think electricity is more akin to what the Internet is doing. In terms of distribution of the technology throughout the population. I guess in the beginning of the Internet, computers were in 30% of American homes, which is one thing that excites people about the net, because they know, we know, that that thing's going to grow. It's going to grow, and some computers won't be the tool used. Web TV is coming on strong, whatever. And what forms it'll eventually end up in, I mean, people were talking about things like Dynabooks in the 1960s. So, who knows how it'll be manifest. And all the homes in America, you know, like 60% of the people had cars in the 30s. I think the better analogy would be the Industrial Revolution. I mean, more directly, the Industrial Revolution began in 1870s, 1880s, and it wasn't until, like you pointed out, until the 30s, until this revolution was able to distribute its wealth or its benefits to 60% of the American homes, namely the automobile, which would not have come about if it weren't for the Industrial Revolution. I think electricity was more of a spinoff, like the Internet is a spinoff of the computer revolution. That's all.
All right, Chad, thanks very much for your call. Mm-hmm. Who'd like to respond to that?
I'll just make one comment, which is that, what I'm looking forward to, I mean, the Internet, I think, is just the beginning, what we're seeing at the moment, really just the beginning. And what I'm looking forward to is it's not only 3 to 5 years out where you don't have to type things in any longer. It'll all be over voice, and there'll be voice recognition and voice answer. And my goodness, once that capability is routinely inside the Internet, oh my God! Could you imagine what we'll be able to do? It'll be unbelievable.
Okay. What will we be able to do?
Yeah, it will be unbelievable. It's a softball for you. Come on.
I think it'll be pretty cool. But I still like reading the good 19th century novel. All this stuff hasn't made novel writing better. It hasn't made playwriting better. It hasn't made, I doubt it's made law briefs any better. It certainly made them a lot bigger. Has it made we've had technological breakthroughs in medicine, but I would think it would help the delivery of medicine at somewhere along the line, but it's sure not obvious yet. But that's
we might see business to business stuff.
I remember the 60s when, this is when I was just getting into college in the late 60s and early 70s, and people were talking about how productivity would soar for the rest of the rest of the century, and everybody expected a helicopter on his windowsill, and there'd be no more roads, and it's been a very exciting time, but I can't tell you how exciting times always were in America, and I'm not sure this excitement is equal to the past excitement. I'm not sure the Internet is comparable to the first time I watched Howdy Doody when I was about 4 years old, compared to what existed before. Uh-huh. In the 1930s, half of all people got their news already from the radio, not from newspapers. We just had one revolution after another. And talking about the Industrial Revolution, which the gentleman brought up, it wasn't cars that were the only output of the Industrial Revolution. There was a wave of riding bicycles in the late 1800s, for example, which was a function of the Industrial Revolution. The development of kerosene lamps, as opposed to having to use whale oil and very expensive candles, was just revolutionary. Suddenly, the average home could, had 3 or 4 more hours to their day because they could actually afford to light their house. So, it's just been take the horseshoe that somebody brought up before in the Middle Ages. That was an enormous breakthrough. Some people consider the harness and horseshoe among the biggest breakthroughs of all time. We need historical imagination in this nation. We don't have enough of it.
Yes, the Internet hasn't changed that.
Well, so we're getting sort of to the heart of the matter, and we're just practically at the end of the program. But I guess basically the question that seems to loom over any conversation about this issue is, if the people who say the productivity is growing, what they're also saying is, watch for huge gains in the next year. We're going to have, in the near term, we're going to have two decades of prosperity, and everyone will be for the kind of prosperity that everybody gets to share in. And it seems like that's the divide between people who think that's going to happen as a result of information technology and those who don't see that panning out.
Right. I think you've asked very perceptive questions, and I think that's the issue. I think this economy is a paradox. There will be very many exciting new products, but it won't create increases in income the way it used to.
And Shane, you are more optimistic.
Saying that these new products are increases in income in some way, and we don't measure them right, but I should let him speak for himself.
Yeah, I mean, on one level, I guess I agree with Jeff. You know, being able to see a picture over the internet and having pornography more available is not, a big improvement in my hierarchy of needs, and I'll sort of concur with that. But I won't concede the point that it will indirectly show up in more productivity down the road. I mean, I think the business-to-business use of this technology is going to be fantastic, and it's changing the nature of work, and we're just not measuring it particularly well.
Are you optimistic that it could change the nature of work in such a way that the productivity gains will be felt by everybody?
Yeah, I think it will change our lives. Yes, I certainly come down on that one.
All right.
I do not think it will raise income levels. Seriously, and that's really the issue.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. Jeff Madrick is editor of Challenge Magazine and the author of The End of Affluence: The Causes and Consequences of America's Economic Dilemma. Shane Greenstein is associate professor in the Management and Strategy Department of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. Thank you both. It was very interesting talking with you.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun.
Thanks very much.
Thanks also to everyone who called. My apologies, as always, to those we didn't get to. Thanks to Carol Frieders and Mike Gilmore for engineering. Thanks to Travis Stansel at Northwestern University. Thanks to Joshua Andrews for producing and directing. Tomorrow, we are going to talk about weather maps. Why? Well, because we have our fundraisers seasonally, and so we like to discuss the weather when that time comes around. We're going to talk with the author of a new book called Air Apparent about the development of weather maps and their use in forecasting the weather. Jerome McDonald is next with Worldview. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. This is Odyssey, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago. Programming on WBEZ is in honor of Dean Hagen, from Dollar Day Club member Janice Rogers, on our 20th wedding anniversary. WBEZ is the radio sponsor for the Dance Center, Columbia College Chicago's Changing Channels Festival of Contemporary Dance. Choreographers Loretta Livingston and Maureen Fleming will premiere two solo dances Thursday, April 22nd through Saturday, April 24th at the Dance Center, 4730 North Sheridan Road. Ticket information is available by calling 773-989-3310.
You're listening to WBEZ Chicago, 91.5 FM. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and coming up next is Worldview. And today we're going to be talking about NATO. The big NATO summit is coming up this weekend. It's their 50th anniversary. We're going to talk about the NATO vision with a few different participants today. We're also going to be hearing from Doug Castle from Northwestern University. He'll have his human rights commentary, and we'll talk about something called the Chiapas Media Project. Stay tuned for all that coming up after the BBC here on WBEZ Chicago.
17 hours Greenwich Mean Time. In the World Service of the BBC, this is David Legg with News Desk. The headlines: as NATO leaders prepare for their summit in Washington, there are signs of a greater readiness by alliance members to send ground troops into Kosovo before a peace agreement is reached. At the same time, Apache attack helicopters have started arriving in Albania to bolster Allied firepower. Countries bordering Kosovo are continuing to struggle to cope with the refugee influx. The Russian parliament has again refused to back President Yeltsin's attempt to sack his controversial prosecutor general. And the power struggle has continued in Iran, with a reformist cleric being sentenced to 18 months in jail on charges of defaming the Islamic system. There are signs within NATO of a hardening of opinion on the possible use of ground troops in Kosovo, whether the Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic agrees or not. The British Defence Secretary George Robertson said NATO would send an international force into the province once, as he put it, airstrikes had done their job so that the Kosovo people could return to their homes. Our diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason says the comments reflect a shift within NATO towards the option of deploying ground forces in a limited form rather than a full-scale invasion.
At the moment, the British government